This week on Out of Chicago, a really, really long interview with an awesome, awesome macro photographer, Mike Motes. Welcome to Out of Chicago. I'm your host, Chris Smith, and this is the show where we talk about Chicago photography, city photography, and photography of all sorts. Actually, today we've got something a little different. It's macro photography. Oh, maybe not totally different. Last week we did butterflies and the Botanic Garden. So this week we have an awesome photographer. It's Mike Motes. Mike is from my hometown of Detroit, lives outside Detroit where I grew up, and I tried to get him online on Skype last week, and I was like, oh man, he couldn't get it to work, and then I couldn't get it to work. I said, well, I'm going out of town. I'm going back to see my folks in Detroit. Well, wait a minute. So we got together, and we actually recorded it live together. Well, not live, but we recorded it together where he actually does a lot of his shooting, or he used to do a lot of his shooting. And so we got together, we each kind of carried a mic on ourselves, and we walked through this, it's called Holland Ponds, and we walked through the whole thing. He helped me with some photography stuff. I was able to ask him a ton of questions. He's such an intelligent guy in terms of the business aspect of photography, so if you're interested in that, you're going to get a ton of it here. I think I warned you right off the bat, it's a really long interview. It's the longest one we've ever done here for Out of Chicago, but I think it's worth it. It's also actually the interview that I've edited down more than any other one. We went out and shot, and I thought maybe we'd do it for about 45 minutes, and we were out there together for two and a half hours, and so I had 2.5 hours worth of material that I've cut down. I've just got the best of the best parts of it, and it still is over an hour long. So I'm not going to say really anything else for this episode. We're going to get right into the interview, and if you're interested in kind of being like a fly on the wall or a fly on our camera backpack following us through the woods here, you're really going to enjoy this. You're going to learn some new tips for macro photography. Mike kind of shoots in a way that is a little bit different than most macro photographers, you'll see as we talk here. And like I said, his business ideas, they're really top-notch. So you're going to learn a lot. You're going to have fun. He's a super fun guy, and it's going to be great. So here we go. This is our interview with Mike Motes, and thank you, Mike.
Oh, I see.
Go here and show you this pond right here. It's kind of interesting because you're literally, 100 feet from the pond right here.
Oh, yeah, it's right there.
This is one pond. There's a bunch of them.
Oh, yeah, I almost walked right into it.
Yeah.
Oh, you'd have no idea from the road this was here.
That's what I'm saying. It's kind of a cool little place.
Yeah, this is awesome.
I just started shooting in 2001, and I was over at Stony Creek one day, and I ran into this bird photographer, and so we started talking about places that she visits, and she goes, have you ever been to Holland Ponds? And, I've lived in this area all my life. Never knew it was here, right?
Yeah.
Because you drive by here, you see a little parking lot, but you don't know.
Right.
There's no sign out there.
Right. Yeah, I never even heard of it. I mean, I grew up south of here, but yeah.
So she says, go to the dead end, 22 Mile at Ryan, and she says it's just north, a little bit north of the 22 Mile, and you'll see parking lot there, and then wander around. There's ponds, there's herons and green herons and all kinds of water birds, of course, in here. And
do you shoot the birds sometimes?
No.
Never?
I'm just all 100% macro.
Good for you.
Yeah. The thing is there's not a lot of people in the macro field that are doing it professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be a specialist so that people don't...
Well, there's not a lot of people teaching it.
No, and that's what helps me sell out workshops.
Which you have been. You've been doing great.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of competition in what I do. If I was a landscape photographer, wildlife photographer, I'd have all kinds of competition. It'd be much tougher to fill classes.
Yeah.
So,
I never thought about that, because a lot of people do macro photography, but not a lot of pros, not a lot of pros that are teaching it.
Most people do it as kind of a side to their landscape and wildlife and that, and they'll do a little macro on the side, but they're not really into it as I've gotten into it.
Now, when you first started shooting, were you doing all sorts of stuff, and then eventually you gravitated to this?
Yeah, oh yeah. When I started out, I actually wanted to do landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And, traveled to Yosemite and out to Acadia and different parks and stuff.
And did you do landscape. That?
Yeah, for 3 years.
Okay.
And then it was in Yosemite when I realized, when I was standing with 45 other photographers trying to capture the same scene.
Exactly.
That I didn't want images that everybody else was shooting. I wanted my own images. So in the macro world, what I realized is that when I go out and shoot a subject, generally within a short period of time, the environment erases that subject. And I'm the only one that saw it, the only one that shot it, and it's gone. Can't be shot again. So when I show my images, they're original images.
Yeah.
They're original subjects that nobody else can capture.
I never thought about
that. When you shoot landscape, everybody can go to the same spot.
Yeah,
and shoot
go to arches or whatever. Everyone's going to hit. Yeah, I mean, maybe the weather's different, but that's
you
about it.
You get a little different clouds or, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But other than that, the rock looks exactly the same. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah, so when I realized that, and being an artistic person and wanting original images, I realized that macro is the way to go. We also have tons of benefits. You know, like today, of course, shooting landscape's pretty difficult, right?
Uh-huh. Some sort of bird out there.
I just saw two green herons earlier.
That might be what it is, because it looked like a heron, but not a great blue.
Yeah, there's tons of birds in here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this would be good for bird photographers for sure.
Yeah, and typically you'll see birders out here when I come out here sometimes. I usually come out here at daybreak, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when there's less wind and,
right,
and
right.
It's a little cooler temperatures in the summertime, of course. And so I'll come out here early in the morning and shoot around daybreak. And then I'll usually catch, as I'm heading out, I'll usually catch some bird guys coming in to shoot. Well, there's one coming out there.
What
there's
do you think
two of them out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I see both of them. What do you think they are? They're small.
I think they're green heron.
Okay.
Because there's quite a few green herons in here.
The one that I see over on that branch over there looks a little bigger.
Yeah, they're herons, but the big blue is, you know, the ones that stay in the water. You can spot those a mile away.
So this looks like it'd be tough to shoot, though. I mean, unless there's something right here in the water.
Yeah, and see, earlier in the year when the lily pads are in better condition, too, because now they start to get pretty nasty looking.
Mm-hmm.
And you get tons more to shoot, you know, and it gets more cluttered up, and you get all this sludge and stuff that starts developing on the water. But earlier in the year when they start to pop up, you can get to capture some nice lily pad shots in here. If you look like out that way, you'll see how the leaves are reflecting in the water, and you get some of that reflection in the water around the lily pads. And
you know, this was a question I wanted to. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you're right. It's a beautiful pattern, not just the lily pads, but the reflection in the water
like
too.
Those three right there would be nice, and then you get the reflections around it. Then you always have a couple other ones that are kind of in there that kind of script your composition. Now you could you could not shoot it, or you could clone it out in Photoshop.
And you don't mind doing that, is that right?
Yeah, okay. No, that's part of the art to me.
Now, how far will you go with that? Well, I mean, some people will go so far as to, here's lily pads I shot here, and I was some other day and I shot these, and
composite
all of it together.
I've never had any interest in cloning some, or, you know, grabbing something here and putting it in over here. That doesn't interest me.
Yeah.
But I don't have any problem with going and cloning out things that are in an image, you know, and copying something over here and putting it over there over top of it. So in other words, getting rid of those two stray pads that are kind of messing up the composition, say.
Because we're looking at it right now, and it looks kind of cool.
Yeah.
But to try and make a photograph of it without those distractions in
it,
like, it's like just looking at it, you can imagine it as being really nice, but
exactly.
To make that photograph is more difficult.
Yeah, so there's always going to be little things in there that we can't control, but with Photoshop we can clone them out, and I don't have any problem with that kind
right.
of stuff. I don't even have a problem with a person taking something out of here and putting it in here. If you've if you've produced a nice-looking image, what do I care how it got done? It's a nice image.
Yeah. My philosophy, just for me, not that anyone else should follow, but my philosophy is always, when someone sees one of my pictures, I want to be able to say, yeah, I was there and it looked really cool. Like right now, Mike, we're looking at this and it's like, yeah, that's pretty cool. Whereas if you took a lily pad from I don't want to tell someone a story. Well, I got this from here and then I was on this trip and I put them all I don't want to tell that story.
Yeah.
I want to say that we were there and it looked pretty cool.
When I was in Yosemite with my buddy there in 2004, the trip I told you I quit doing landscape.
were you standing there with the 40 photographers and you realize right now this is
it? Yeah, it was on that evening when I was shooting, and we had a lot of time waiting for the sun to get the right, and you're just sitting there standing there talking with guys and thinking, and it just dawned on me. I said, you know what? I don't really have any interest in shooting this now because I'm capturing the same thing everybody else is shooting. And that happens 365 days there in that same spot.
Right.
Guys are there every evening shooting that shot. The thing about that kind of stuff is a buddy of mine who was a commercial photographer that went with me out there, he shot all these landscapes at Yosemite, and they're all like this, no clouds, you know, 7 days of blue sky, no cloud, the worst kind of background.
Right, right.
And he had all these beautiful skies that he would shoot of storms and stuff like that. And then he pulled these storms and incorporated into his landscapes that he shot at Yosemite, and they look beautiful.
Okay.
And you would have never known.
But that goes back to my thing,
yeah.
Is that I want to be able to say something to someone, oh, I was in front of it, and not only that, but it was this wonderful sky, yeah. It was awesome. I don't want to be the person that says, well, I had some skies from another trip.
Yeah.
And
the difference is, see, you know, you're creating, documenting what really happened, where he's creating art.
Yeah,
he's taking images and creating art with those two images, whereas you want to document what you saw that day.
Yeah.
So it depends on where you come from.
And sometimes I definitely go way too far with Photoshop and things like that. I mean, I'm guilty of it, but...
You got a big bullfrog?
Yeah, it's right down there, I think.
Yeah.
But to me, half of the fun of photography is the adventure.
Yeah.
And being able to say, oh, I saw that, it was great, you know, so that's just...
Yeah, so I don't have the skills or even the desire to do that type of photography. I don't have any.
Not even for yourself?
That, no.
Not even to get a couple of great pictures of Yosemite in your house?
Pull out something here and
put it in here? Oh, no. I mean the landscape stuff.
Oh, no.
I thought what you were talking about.
No, God, I've been to all kinds of places since 2004 and saw beautiful landscapes. And I was up in Alaska for 10 days. Didn't shoot one landscape.
I know. Oh, you didn't?
No.
You're just not interested?
No, not interested.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right, well, should we walk a little bit?
Yeah.
Now, when you shoot those or... Well, anything. Do you always use a tripod?
Yeah.
Always. Every 100% of your shots.
Yeah, I have a little point-and-shoot that I've been shooting with lately. It's a Canon G16.
Mm-hmm.
And, hand-holding that, of course. But it's setting you up at 2.8 all the time, so you're shooting your small aperture numbers, and you,
sure.
So you can get a faster shutter speed. The problem is it doesn't give you enough depth of field. Most of the time I want depth of field to get more in focus.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're using longer shutter speeds... It's kind of a problem hand-holding. It's tough to
hand-hold
F-32.
Right, we're shooting F-32, is that what you said?
I shoot a lot of F-32.
That's great. Well, okay, so that brings up another question. Do you worry about diffraction? Is that a thing?
No, it used to be a problem back in the film days, but nowadays all these sharpening tools we have, any little softness that we get from diffraction, your unsharp mask, of course, in Photoshop, uh-huh. And then you go into Nik software, which has detail extractors and tonal contrast and got structure tools.
But will you do all those things on one shot? Like a detail extractor and tonal contrast and unsharp mask and...
No, usually because any of those will give you a lot of sharpening to your image. And when you start applying on top of it, then it gets too much.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it gets crazy. So one of the nice things about here is they do start to get a lot of wildflowers around here, and they're fairly easy to get to if you see something here.
All right.
Now, I do have a diffuser with me, so we can shade these if you want to shoot any.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, what do you do when it gets a little later in the day? You use, like,
a
diffuser?
Just pop this guy right out here.
I got to be honest with you that I'm usually shooting buildings down in Chicago. I'm not necessarily a macro guy, but here I am. But I think I'm kind of like you. I mean, there was a time in my life when I was doing macro, and I was doing birds, and I was doing landscape. I was doing all sorts of stuff,
yeah.
And it ended up, I mean, I live right near Chicago, so I end up doing a lot of buildings now.
Yes, yep.
What's the lens that you use here?
This is an 18-270.
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah, and so this is what I use 90% of the time. What's nice about it has the 18 millimeters, because a lot of times for teaching purposes, I want to show the environment I shot something in.
Yeah.
Say, well, I shot this, but here's the environment I shot in. So I got 18 millimeters, so I can get a wide angle. And then if I'm shooting a frog at the in a pond out a ways, or leaves floating in a pond, like,
sure.
I mentioned, or ice abstracts, then I can zoom out to 270, and that'll reach out and capture that frog. It'll focus down as small as 2 inches by 3 inches.
Jeez, but
so what I am is really a close-up photographer.
Okay, so you don't call it macro.
Yeah,
I mean
macro would be if you're shooting with your traditional macro lens,
yeah.
In a 1-to-1 range.
Mm-hmm.
You're shooting about 7/8 of an inch by 1 3/8, that small of an area.
Okay.
Very few times are we shooting that small of an area. Generally, we're shooting outside of that area, which is considered close-up photography. If you look at all my images, 800 and some images, I think it is on my website, there's probably only maybe a dozen that are actually true macro images in that 1-to-1 range.
Okay, I would not have guessed that. Yeah, I was going to tell you you're doing it wrong, Mike. You should have a macro lens.
I do.
You should use it more than 10% of the time.
If there's a situation where I want to get into that 7/8 of an inch by 3/8, then I pull out the Tamron 90 millimeter.
You know, I was just thinking that you probably use the macro lens all the time.
No.
And then my question was going to be, do you ever do, like, the extreme macro? Like, I've got, like, the bug's eye, and it's just the eye. So you never do that stuff. Just not interesting, or?
Yeah, I'm not into bugs for one thing.
Okay.
Yeah. I started out wanting to do artwork for people to hang in their homes. Not many people are buying bugs' heads and spiders
like
that. So for me, I'm trying to create artwork for homes. And so that just didn't fit into my philosophy and my style and what I wanted to do. Not to say that I don't have a few butterflies and dragonfly shots on my website,
right,
because there are people that are interested in that, that follow me in that. But I don't go after that. You'll see very few bug shots on my website compared to other stuff.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that people, you know, some of these photographers that are shooting for National Geographic or something, they're out there shooting and they're like, oh, this could be a cover. Oh, this could be a 2-page wide spread or whatever.
Right.
But in your head, as you're shooting, are you actually thinking, like, this could be artwork in someone's home? Is that actually part of, like, how you're actually framing up the shot based on making a work for that?
Exactly. Something that somebody would buy to hang in their home. Because in the beginning years when I started this, it was I was doing art shows and selling my work.
That's do you still do those or you don't?
No. Because the teaching got big enough where the art shows, and the art shows started to drop off in sales.
Okay.
As the economy got bad, sales were dropping off, and it was getting worse and worse. And so the money was getting tough to make in the art show business. Galleries are really tough to make any money in because the foot traffic is so low in a gallery. And you just don't sell enough in galleries to make a living at it.
Yeah.
And
Art Wolf
art shows,
was telling me the other day that the gallery works for him, but he's Art Wolf. I mean, kind of.
Yeah, and you know, if you can set up in a touristy type area, maybe with your stuff.
Well, that's what he said. He said he's got one in New York and one in Vegas.
You can't do it in this little area here in some small town, you know, set up a gallery and expect to make a living at it. It ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
Peter Lick is a good example of someone that's made millions of dollars selling his work, but he's in Las Vegas, three galleries in Las Vegas, in big hotels. He's in Key West. He's in Maui. Those are tourist traps. And those are people that come there to have money. That's why they're there. And he's got a traffic flow, daily traffic flow of new people on a daily basis.
Right.
You set it
well,
up.
Well, why
here
don't
and,
you do it?
You know how much
Mike
money
Moats
would
in
cost?
Vegas.
You know how much
I don't
it would
know.
Cost? Oh my God! It probably cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars to set up to do that. Not to mention signing contracts that you would lock into if it didn't work out. That you'd be
have to
liable
pay,
for
pay
it.
The people to run the thing.
You know, he did it and it worked for him. But I know another really, really good photographer that does European photography of buildings and all that, that went into a casino
it.
And tried it. And he's really, really done well in the art show circuit. Pretty well known as far as, you know, what he does. But he went into, you know, a gallery and set up a gallery and lasted a year and he's out. And for whatever reason, it works for some and it doesn't work for others. All the guys that I know that did try galleries in their local cities or whatever, within a year they were out of business.
Yeah.
You know, there's just not enough money in it. So I always tell people, let's say you get into a gallery and the gallery lets you have a space for three or four of your prints to hang. So in that small gallery, on a daily basis, maybe they get 20 people that walk through there. Out of the 20, how many of those 20 are actually coming in looking for photography? Maybe one or two, maybe,
right,
if you're lucky. And then out of that one or two that may be coming in looking for photography, what's the chances they're looking for nature photography that you do, right? And then out of your hundreds and hundreds or thousands of images that you have to choose from, you choose three or four images to hang in at. What is the chances that you pick
the ones that they want?
That few people are going to, that'll fit with the colors in their home and the room they're going to put in all this stuff.
Right.
It's a small, small chance that you can sell those things.
Right.
And so galleries don't work very well. I mean, you can make a sale here and there, but, you know, you're not a living, that's for sure.
So do you sell your... Do you still sell your stuff then, or are you mostly going off your workshops?
No, I have a company called GreatBigCanvas.com that sells my images, and they do all the printing and the selling of it, and they do all the promoting of it and all that, and they sell, the last 3 months, they sold $46,000 of my images.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wait, so you do?
That's the retail.
So you do sell.
I get a percentage of that.
Sure.
Yeah.
But so your stuff is being sold. You're just not doing it yourself.
I'm not doing it myself.
Well, that's how
I used to do it myself. I mean, I used to print them and sell them and, and go to the art shows and do about 20, 25 art shows a year and stand out there every weekend, you know, selling that stuff. And there were times when, you know, you could do $9,000-$10,000, and then there was times when you'd do $500.
And you spent the weekend,
depending on the show and...
Right.
And,
the weather and a lot of factors, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It rains out that weekend, you're not going to make any sales.
Right.
So when the sales dropped off in the art show business, I decided to do more workshops. Well, the workshops were doing so well and selling out that it was guaranteed money.
Whereas you know what? And I've had four or five of my friends that have done your workshops, and I've only heard great things.
Yeah,
so,
thanks.
I mean, not only are you... Did you find the right thing to do? But it sounds like you're doing a great job with it.
I seem to have a way of simplifying things to where it's easy to understand.
Yeah.
And I hear so many people say that. They go, oh, yeah, this guy was telling us how to do this, but he gets so complicated and so technical, I couldn't understand what he was doing. I try to break it down so that the lowest person skill-wise in the class can understand it. And it's been working really, really well for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was what Einstein said. He said, make everything as simple as possible, but... No simpler than that.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah, and I'm that way. You know, I'm very simple, and I want everything easy, and I don't want to, you know, make it complicated for myself either. So I think...
And a lot of people, I think, make it complicated. Like, a lot of professionals, almost to be like, well, look what I can do, and
right.
you guys will never be able to do that.
Right.
But it sounds like you're going the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, the same with the equipment. I'm using a D7000. You can buy that for $900.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember reading this. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and it's all the same stuff that other people could use.
The people that take my workshop use. And as long as I can get it good quality pro-level images, then that means they're going to be able to do that. And when they leave that class, there's no excuses. You know? In other words, it's operator error if you're not getting
right.
it done. Because I'll take anybody's camera and take great macro shots.
Now, if you, let's say that the art fair circuit, whatever, is still going great or whatever else, and you aren't doing workshops.
I'd jump back in.
Well, yeah, of course, but I'm saying, let's say you are doing that.
Yeah.
Would you use different lenses then?
No.
Or this is...
Because this is working.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not just because of the workshops. This is all you really need. You really
yeah.
mean that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty lucky because being in a position where I teach workshops and teach a lot of people and speak at photo conferences, companies want to be connected with you and they give you stuff. So everything that I have, everything that you see here is given to me except for the body.
Oh, wow.
The body, Nikon gives nothing away.
Okay.
Generally.
Yeah.
They're pretty cheap.
Yeah.
So, and the only
well, I think
I'm,
I was talking with Bill Fortney the other day. Actually, I just keep dropping names here,
yeah.
if you don't mind.
But, well, Bill's a friend of mine. So,
oh, good.
Yeah.
Great, great. But he was what? He was like the Nikon rep or whatever, and he
yeah.
right, like the
yeah.
main or technical rep or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he said, yeah, yeah, I had to buy all my stuff. It was
yeah.
ridiculous. I mean,
yeah.
come on. So
right.
Yeah.
exactly right. It, you know, the only reason I'm with Nikon is because I was originally with Fuji, who sponsored me. Now
yeah,
Fuji gave me cameras.
Okay.
Because they're a small company, they needed people to promote them. So
uh-huh.
they'd say, hey, we'll give you the camera, just use it, you know. So I was using their cameras, and then when they stopped making SLRs, their last SLR didn't have live view, and I wanted live view.
Yeah.
So I had to buy a camera to get the live view. So their cameras were based on Nikon bodies, and my lenses were already mm. fitted for Nikon. So
mm-hmm.
that's how I ended up with Nikon. I have no preference to one camera.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think... Yeah, I bought my first like point and shoot. It was a Canon, and then I'm like, well, I'll buy a Rebel. I'll buy, and it's like I've just had
yeah.
Canon ever since. But I mean, it's just because of that first point and shoot that
they're
I bought.
They're all good,
exactly.
Yeah,
I agree.
They're all good cameras. And so, yeah, that whole issue of like you know Canon, Nikon, Sony, all that stuff, that doesn't mean anything to me.
I think people are finally figuring that out a little bit. I think enough people like you and I are saying that. And I think they're figuring that out.
There
Although you
those...
go online and people still fight it out, right?
Oh, yeah. There's pros. There was a person in my workshop that took a workshop, and I forget the leader. It was a pretty big-name person that said in you know to their, all of his students there that if you're not shooting a Canon camera, then you're not going to get the best images.
Really?
Which is just a totally ridiculous thing to say, especially if you've just offended maybe half of your people are shooting Nikon or Sony.
Right, right. Sure, of course.
Yeah. You yeah. just told those people that you're not going to get good images with the camera they spent their money
mm-hmm.
on, which is offending your people in your workshop, for one thing.
Right.
And it's just a stupid thing to say. This is, you know, I mean...
Right.
You can still get great images. If you have a good subject and you compose it properly, you're going to get great images with any camera.
Yeah.
I got some amazing images with my point and shoot, you know what I mean?
Well,
I've been putting online and everybody assumes I'm shooting it with this. And they're beautiful.
You are Mike Motz, though. So.
They're beautiful. I mean, again, good subject matter, composed properly,
mm-hmm.
that's where it's at.
I agree.
You know, all cameras will do a good job.
Well, and it is amazing. So, I mean, you couldn't use it for everything, but it's amazing some of the photos you see from people's iPhones, you know,
oh,
that
yeah.
are, you know, they
oh,
you
yeah.
can do great. So.
Yeah. And I do tell people in my workshop, I say, you know, any digital SLR will produce great macro images. Now, I'm not going to tell you that this is going to be a great bird photography camera.
Right, right.
Or a great sports photographer, you know, for a great sport. You know, we want high shutter speeds per second and you want low light conditions with high ISOs, then you're not going to do that with this camera. But for what we do, which is macro, when I'm teaching my workshop, any camera you have is going
to
do fine.
That's a good point. Is there anything in particular you need to look for if you're shooting a lot of macro, a lot of close-up? I mean, as long as it That's what you're saying, as long as it's a digital camera. And
I show everybody in my workshop, my most successful of all my images was shot in Yosemite when I was there. It was a black, it was a green fern on a black log.
Okay.
It's the most successful image of all I've had. It's won contests, more contests, and it's been in more, it's been an outdoor photographer, three different issues.
Wow.
It's been, it's owned by Hewlett-Packard. Hewlett-Packard bought the rights to that image from it. It's my most successful image, and it was shot with a Fuji S2, a 6-megapixel, generations ago.
Exactly, yeah.
Anything you buy today is way better than what I had in 2004.
The cheapest one you can get today would still be better.
And it's still a fantastic image and my most successful. And I used to blow that thing up to 24 by 36 and sell it at art shows.
Wow. Have you considered doing Fuji and looking at the new mirrorless cameras?
Yeah, actually, Bill contacted me because he's been working with the Fuji, and I think he's kind of working a little with Fuji people there. And so he contacted me about, you know, well, you want to try Fuji? I says, you know, I already have a Panasonic Lumix, the G3, I think.
Okay.
I have. And I said, I've used it, and I said, it's they're great cameras, but I'm still happy with my system. And I'm not carrying that much weight, that big of a camera anyways. It's a pretty lightweight system.
Right.
So weight-wise, it doesn't really mean that much. And I don't travel that far to my places where I shoot. I'm not walking miles to get to it. So the weight issue is not a problem. So I'm happy with what I have right now. But the mirrorless camera is obviously doing great work. The problem with the mirrorless is, you know, just the lenses. You know, you're limited on for macro lenses with the mirrorless cameras now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, some people say, well, you can take your regular lenses and attach them on there. Well, what's the point in having this little body with a big lens on it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, why do you say it? I mean, they do have a macro lens, and they do have a super zoom lens, I think, kind of similar to this
Not sure that their zoom lenses will focus in as tight as this
one. Oh, I see. This gives you not only that wide range, but you can also go close.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Why don't we shoot these teasers?
Yeah, let's
do fun.
Something here. Oh, cool.
Yeah, these are pretty fun to shoot. Now,
they're very cool.
It's nice they're kind of a little bit shaded, too. Now, usually what happens in the macro world is that people always, you know, they think that in order to blur out these backgrounds, okay?
Oh, that's something I need to know. You got to help me here.
In order to blur out that background, you use a small f-stop, right? Because
that'll work,
depth of
but then you're gonna, especially on these are pretty deep.
Yeah, you don't get enough on that. So what you have to do is you have to position yourself in a position towards the subject with the background way off in a distance. See?
Right.
And that allows you to go to a bigger f-stop. Because, you know, maybe at a f/11 you won't reach back and pull in any of that grass back there, that detail. See. So if you get in right in here and you shoot this guy here and you can find the camera angle and get that background way back there as your background, now you've got a much greater chance of going to a higher f-stop, getting this more in focus and still blurring the background. If you shoot it from this angle and that's your fence as your background, there's no way you're going to go to an f/11, f/16 without getting that fence in there and screwing up your shot. So that's how you get those blurred backgrounds, is you got to work that subject and work the around the subject with the camera angle, because if I was to position myself here, there's the background there. Well, maybe that's 40 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
But if I position myself here and I look, there's my background 100 feet away, that's much better.
Right. Yeah, so we forgot to bring the video crew today, but so just to describe it a little bit better, I mean, what did you say these are?
These are teasels.
Okay, so we've got the teasels, and they're all along the fence line here.
Yep.
But if you shoot it, the easiest thing would be to come up and shoot it with the fence right behind, but it's, you know, 8-10 feet behind it, that's you're going to get a bad background.
Yep.
So he's actually walking closer to into them a little bit, closer to the fence, so that the background is 100
feet
away.
You could choose, say, that one right there, because you could get right in here to shoot it, and there's nothing behind it from there all the way to that grass or that bush back there, and so you could probably get f/11, maybe even f/16.
Okay.
And now you're going to get more depth of field on that subject.
Huh?
No, probably not f/32.
Because it's going to make
that's going to really give you more depth of field. But depending on how close you get to that subject, f/32 will give you a shallow depth of field too, and may not reach back there.
Now,
I always tell people to vary their f-stops too.
Oh,
in other words, when you set up and shoot this, don't just set one f-stop,
because
you get home and you go, oh, darn, I wish I'd have done this, right?
Right.
So I tell them to vary their f-stop. So shoot it, you know, I would go at least smallest at f8, f11, f16, 22, and then go to 32. And then when you get home, you can decide which one works
the
best.
Pick the one you want. Now, will you ever take those and merge them as layers in Photoshop, or that's just not your thing?
No.
No,
they do what they call focus stacking.
Sure, and you don't do that either?
No.
Okay.
No, I've just learned how to work my subject with the backgrounds, and I can get it shot one time.
But even without focus stacking, you could take one like at 5.6 and you could take one at F32 and simply put the two layers in Photoshop, and but that's not your thing.
No, I don't even have the Photoshop that'll do that.
Oh,
I use Elements.
Oh, wow. Well,
that
is impressive.
Photoshop Elements.
Do you use Lightroom as well, or just Elements and that's it?
Yeah. Most of my processing is done in Nix Software and Topaz.
Okay, so I was going to ask you about that. Do you just go straight to those programs then?
Yeah.
I guess you would.
I still have to go into Elements because it's a plug-in.
Okay.
So I still have to enter into Elements and then take it into
Nix
Software or Topaz.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because, you know, they're not standalone programs.
I thought that they were. I thought that the Nix ones...
They got to plug in. They plug into Elements, Lightroom, CS programs, and Aperture. Those are the programs they plug into.
Okay.
So... I still need Elements, not only just to plug it in, those software programs, but I still need it for cloning, cropping, resizing.
Right, right.
So I still have to have that program for
that. But that gives you everything you need, huh?
Yeah, but I don't need to spend a lot of money for a program just to crop, clone, and resize. You know?
Sure, sure.
So I buy the cheapest, which is the Elements, and then my software programs are what really do all my processing on my
You haven't even been recommending, like, the... Well, you don't even use Lightroom, you said.
No.
I just feel like the new $9.99 a month or whatever, you get Lightroom and Photoshop.
Yeah, it's a great deal.
Yeah.
You know...
But you're saying you don't even need that?
No.
Wow.
No, if you don't want to be making monthly payments. And the problem is what happens when you decide you can't make that monthly payment. Maybe you lose your job and you say it's not worth it. You lose all the programs.
You know, they just changed that just a week ago.
So you can keep them?
Well, in Lightroom... You can't use the develop module anymore, but you'll be able to do everything else. So you'll still be able to access your photos and export them and do a lot of stuff, but just not like some of the develop part. Yeah.
Okay, because that's what would worry me.
Yeah, well, I think it was...
they cut you off, you had no programs.
Yeah, I think it was Lightroom 5.5, just like a week or two ago, and that was in there. So, should you shoot this or should I?
No, I'm not going to shoot it. I've shot these 100 times.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, set this up and then get down low. The other thing about macro, of course, is we're... A lot of times on our knees and stuff.
Right. Do you have knee pads for that one?
Normally
usually...
I do, but I wasn't planning on getting down too much here.
You're going to tell me to. I got you. All right.
The problem that we're going to run into today is because we've got the sun, and so our background now is going to be a problem because it's going to have blown out areas and going to have darker areas back there.
Right.
And so sometimes you look at it and you go, you know what? That's not going to work. And so you walk away.
Okay. Maybe I could try and shoot it this way
you
and
could,
further down the fence
into
line.
The darker area. So in other words, from here into that dark area right there.
Yeah, I'm
so
going
to
try that.
You've got a darker background and try that.
All right. So then the next question is, what shutter speed should I make sure I'm getting? It's kind of moving a little bit.
I'd be more worried about your f-stop.
Okay.
First.
So I got.
And then once
like,
you set your f-stop, you can check your shutter speed. And if shutter speed's real slow, then you can bump the ISO up.
Okay. So.
Because we're more interested in the depth of field than we are the shutter speed. So we want to make sure we get that set.
So put your aperture, lock it in, and then do everything else.
And then shoot it again, F8, F11, F16, 22.
It's interesting. This is really similar to what I teach when I'm doing my night photography down in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it's like you set your aperture because that's going to determine, you know, what depth of field you got. And then don't change that. And then everything else. And if you got to bump up the ISO, you got to bump up the ISO.
Exactly.
But... The other thing that's the same is that people are so concerned about the exposures when you're shooting at night because you got bright lights, you got all this other stuff, and it's exactly like you say. We just, you know, shoot one a little brighter, shoot one a little darker, shoot, you know, get four or five of them, and you'll have your choice when you get home.
Exactly.
But with macro, it sounds like the concern more is the is shooting different f-stops.
Oh, yeah. Depth field is all, it's all about depth of field because when we're shooting your buildings and you're, you know, half a mile away from a building or you're shooting a mountain, depth of field increases. It's huge.
Right.
So you can shoot at F8, F11s and get great depth of field. That's not the case in macro. When you go to F8, man, you're getting hardly nothing in focus.
Yeah.
So it's a big issue for us.
Do you use your depth of field preview?
Or
do you just shoot it and see what it looks
sometimes,
like?
Sometimes. But usually... the depth of field preview is good till about F16, maybe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, after that it's too dark. It's hard to see.
Oh, right.
And so if I'm shooting higher ISO, I know I'm going to get enough depth of field, so I don't need to check it. Where I check it is about shooting 5.6, 6.3, F8,
okay.
I want to see. Then I might use it in that lower ranges.
Gotcha. You know?
But when I go into shoot with higher F-stops, I know I'm going to get enough depth of field generally, depending on how close I am again to that subject. And that.
Yeah. All right, okay, any hope for this shot, or am I just got to move on?
Okay, so we've got, and it's okay if a stem leaves the frame.
Okay.
But what you don't want is you don't want the tip of it touching the edge of the frame.
Sure.
So,
I've make got, it intentional if you're going to do it.
Exactly. Show that the viewer that, you know, hey, I wanted that to leave the frame. I just didn't crop it too tight and end with the tip touching the other frame. So I've got this in the frame, I got this in the frame, and the other ones are going outside the frame, and that's okay.
You know what? I'm going to try and set this up and make it perfect. Tell us a little bit about your history. I mean, your background is awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you get into photography in the first place, and how did you get to the point you are now?
It's amazing. Actually, I do a lot of outdoor stuff, you know, mountain biking, and I got into mountain climbing for a couple of years. So I was training for Mount Rainier and Mount Shasta, and I did climbs on those. And I would hike in all these areas for practice. I'd carry a big, you know, heavy backpack and my big mountaineering boots, and I'd go out there in my hiking poles and I'd train. And I spent hours and hours just hiking at Stony Creek in here and that.
Really?
And I would see all this stuff out here. And it hit me one day. I thought, you know what? This would be cool to come out here and photograph this stuff.
Well, you're talking maybe 15, 20 years ago now?
No, 2001.
Oh, okay. No, yeah. But I mean when you said you were doing the backpacking.
Oh,
that was
in 2000 and 2001, the 2 years that I was doing the mountaineering thing. And so, I after I came back from Mount Rainier, actually, is when I decided to buy a camera and come out here and start doing photographs. And it just caught on, and I just had such a ball. I was having so much fun, and it was giving me an excuse to come out here.
Right. Well, that's the best part about photography is it gives you a reason to get out.
Yeah,
because
it's nice to come out here and hike for exercise and all, but after you've hiked here a million times, it gets old after a while. Right.
Right. Well,
but to come out here when you're doing what we're doing, I mean, on a monthly basis, this changes every month. You come out here and you see new things and you photograph different stuff. That's the great thing about macro too, is that the environment's constantly changing out here on a monthly basis. You come through the same circle that we're going to do and you'll find new things to shoot. And the advancements of the plants, they're either starting to decay or they're, you know, growing up and getting bigger or whatever. They're changing all the time.
It's always changing. Yeah. That's kind of a problem with Chicago. And we'll get ice and stuff. But,
A little different weather environment changes things, but the buildings and stuff, they stay
the
same.
They're always the same. That's a great point.
And once you've shot them, then that's it.
So you started shooting 2001.
Yeah, and then for 3 years, I was just learning, trying to figure out what I was doing because I didn't know what I was doing.
Well, and, just like everyone else, right?
Yeah. My brother had said, he goes, you know, you've got some nice images here. You ever think about sending them off to some of these photo magazines and see if you get something published? And I go, no, I never really thought of it, but that would be kind of a goal. That might be a nice goal, you know. So if I could get an image published, that'd be pretty cool. And so I sent off 20 images to the editor, outdoor photographer, and within 2 weeks they called and says, we're going to publish that green fern on the black log.
You got to be kidding me. So.
And that fuels the fire then, right?
Well, of course. But you weren't even putting stuff like, I mean, I guess now, well, even then probably, putting stuff online or whatever.
Oh, no.
You
I wasn't just, online then.
You were backpacking, you took some photos, straight to outdoor photographer.
Yeah.
So you got to be kidding me.
So then I sent off images to Nature Photographer magazine, and I got images published in there, and then I sent an article to Outdoor Photographer magazine, and the first article I sent was published. And then I started sending them to Nature Photographer magazine, got articles published there, and then it just kind of went on. And then I thought, well, if these editors, these magazines think I'm doing pretty good, you know, and I got online then on some of the critique sites, and I was getting really good reviews from the people on the websites and stuff, so I thought, well, maybe I can sell these images. And that's how I got looked into the art show business and went to some galleries and got into some galleries and started selling.
And then, how long did you do that for?
Well, that lasted for a couple of years in the selling part, but then I realized that if I was going to try to make a living with this, the art shows only lasted up here from September, early April till September, and that I was going to have a problem in the winter months trying to make money.
Right.
So I started putting signs in my booth at the art shows, macro workshops.
Perfect.
Yeah, so the first summer that I did my art shows, and I'd done some over in Chicago with that Amy Amadour. She's got all those big shows over there. I've done some of her shows, and I did, you know, Ohio, I did in Michigan, Illinois, Indiana. So I set up this sign, on all three walls of my booth had a sign on each wall so you couldn't miss it, right? In the first summer, I accumulated 1,000 names on a mailing list.
Yeah.
1,000 names in the first summer. And so I set up my workshops in local hotels in Rochester Hills, right here in not far from here.
Uh-huh.
And I did something like 29 straight workshops.
All here?
In just at that location in Rochester Hills.
So all people, well, people
all people that came in from my art shows that I did, because every year I would keep putting a sign out. I'd get new people every
year. Wow.
So each year you'd accumulate a whole big bunch of names again, and then you'd send out information, and then in the winter months you'd do your workshop.
You're a smart guy.
Yeah, and then and then I realized that you can't just do them in Southeast Michigan for the rest of your life, so I got to go outside. Well, luckily I'd been online from 2004 until, you know, a couple years ago when I started doing them outside of Michigan. And just bombarding the internet with my images everywhere I could put them, every site I could find to put my images, I was putting them out there. So people got to know me, followed me, followed my blog, all that kind of stuff. So when I did my first workshop outside of Michigan, it was in San Diego, in Carlsbad, north of San Diego. It sold out in no time, and I called the hotel and booked the second weekend and sold that out. So it told me that there's people who are watching that are outside of my area. I did something like, I don't know, 30 or 40 of these boot camps in a row. Sold out every one until one finally didn't sell out. But I've done over 100 of them, and I think only about 3 or 4 haven't sold out.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, you go on your site and you see even your upcoming ones, and half of them are sold out, and you just put them out there.
Yeah, and that's just because I'd spent so much time on the internet. I mean, 365 days posting my images everywhere.
Wow.
And people see you and they start to follow you. And so when they see you're in their area where they live, and you've got a workshop, they want to take it.
Where have you had the most response online posting your images? Is it Facebook? Is it?
Yeah. You know, the photographers always talk about that Google Plus. You know,
yes.
I get no response.
You know what? Everyone tries it, and yeah,
I've got 10,000 people that they're following me in a circle.
Right.
And I was just looking the other day. I post there every day, just like I do everywhere else. I mean, I got 5 posts in a row with not one even a like on it.
I'm going to have to get you to sign something for me.
I was going to say I could ship you one. I don't think I have. No, I don't, because I don't have my bag in there.
You take your reflector. I don't know.
With MM on there?
Yeah. No, that makes you
The reason
you
why
sign
my initials
too.
On there is because in the workshops, when I do the workshops, people say, can I borrow your reflector? Well, I don't get them back.
Right,
you know.
Right. I thought it was Wes Welker there for a minute, but I was looking at it upside down.
Now this area here, you used to be able to see. There's a pond down here. You used to see all this. There's a canal here.
Oh yeah.
This canal was originally built here for boats to go from Lake St. Clair across Michigan over Lake Michigan. Yep.
Lake Michigan?
Yeah. They were going to build a canal that'll take a boat from here all the way over Lake Michigan, and they actually started it. And this is the actual canal they started to dig, and then they ran out of money.
I was going to say, yeah. I'm like, I don't remember a canal.
Yeah. Yep, and this is the original. They've got a sign up here that kind of explains it. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's cool.
But yeah, they were going to do shipping from this side of the state to the other side with this canal. And then I think it was like around the Depression thing when they ran out of money and all that, and economy and all that stuff got bad. But if you've seen that shot of my frog with the head sticking out of the water,
I think so.
That's out of this pond
right here.
Yeah, it was on the other side. And again, you could get down there and walk down the edge of the pond, and there's frogs everywhere with their head sticking out.
So tell us what you do on your
workshops. Well, Friday evening is all about equipment. So we cover all the equipment that you know, the accessories and whatever you need to do what I do. And then Saturday we start working with depth of field. And we kind of talk about, you know, finding that right subject with the background way off, like we were just doing.
Yeah.
And we cover composition, elements of design, I call them. Cover finding character in nature. 2 subject compositions, which has been the style that I've shot, and it's done really well for me. And then we go into some Photoshop work, Nick software, Topaz, and then they get to shoot for 2 hours. So that goes from 9 until 5. And then on Sunday, we cover Helicon Focus, and we show some more how-to things that you can do at home and little tricks and tips and things like that. And then we do more shooting on Sunday, and then it ends at 2 o'clock.
So when you come to a town, you roll in, people come in for Friday evening, all day Saturday almost, it sounds like.
Yeah,
and
9 to 5.
And then the morning on Sunday.
We get a lot of people from out of state. So when I'm in an area, a lot of people that are surrounding states will come in. So that gives them the daytime on Friday to drive in or fly in if they're flying in.
Mm-hmm.
Start at 5:30. And then on Sunday we end at 2, so it gives them time to get home or fly out on Sunday afternoon or evening, or if they need to get back home to go to work on Monday.
I can't imagine how much better photographer you'd be Sunday night compared to Friday morning.
You learn a lot, a huge amount of stuff.
Now, I think you build this on your site as for beginners and intermediate. Is that right?
Basically, not that an advanced person couldn't come in and learn something. There's a lot of information that's more basic and to the beginner intermediate. And so there's a lot of sitting that they're going to listen to things they already know. Most advanced photographers aren't interested in a class like this typically because they already figured they're advanced. They don't need a class. Mm-hmm. So you don't really get advanced. So it's geared more to the beginners, to the intermediates.
So do you offer something for the people that are a little more advanced?
No. You know, the advanced part typically is just about composition, subject matter, you know, finding character, nature, things like that. Because if you're advanced, you know how to work your camera. Mm-hmm. You know the f-stops, and shutter speeds, and focusing. You can do that. So the advanced part is composition, subject matter, that kind of stuff.
But I know hundreds of photographers that know their settings of their camera and know the basic rules of composition and have done all these things, but they're not taking images like yours.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of it is from the learning process that I went through in my art show, knowing what people like, knowing what won in contests. So that's the advanced part to me, and that's kind of what the advanced part is when I do the photo conferences and I talk about, and when I talk about advanced, I'm teaching people what works and what doesn't work as far as your images, because you can be really good technically with your camera, but take terrible pictures because you can't find good subjects that people can relate to and connect with.
Right.
And maybe you're not good at composing them. But some people figure, you know, if they got the camera tech stuff down, they're advanced.
Right.
And to me, advanced is knowing a good subject from a bad subject and knowing how to compose it properly. And it's, you know, I know when I post my images online of soft focus flowers or abstracts that I'll get a good response from photographers because they love that stuff and they understand depth of field and so they get what I'm doing. When I show those same images to friends and family and people that are non-photographers, they don't get it. See,
really?
They don't understand why it's out of focus. They don't understand this abstract that they can't connect with. In the art show business, I learned that when people were buying images from me, I'd ask them, why are you buying this to hang in your home? I want to know that so that helps me understand where the buyer is coming from. Every single time there was a connection to the subject, and that's why they were buying the images. That's why they liked the images, because they could connect with that subject.
And you found that when you had everything in focus, they were able to connect better.
Yeah,
typically.
Exactly, because see, everybody that takes pictures of their family events and things like that has a point and shoot. What does a point and shoot do good?
Yeah, and great depth of field.
Gets it all in focus. See, so they view their photography and they see everything in focus. They assume that's the way photographs are supposed to be. They don't understand shallow depth of field like we do, and working with SLRs and getting that shallow depth of field. So, you know, I'd have people come in and question why things are out of focus. They would look at abstracts and they go, "Well, so what is it?" They want to connect, and when they have to try to figure out what it is, they don't seem to like it. Now, photographers, they like it because they come from a different background. They're artistic, tend to be, right? And they're looking at the image as an abstract, is not trying to figure out what it is. They're looking at it from a point of it's a design. There's a cool design there. There's lines. There's textures. There's contrast. That's what they're looking at, and that's what I look at when I see subjects. The person that's a non-photographer, all they're looking for is a subject matter they can identify and connect with.
I remember hearing something about there was research done on people and saying how beautiful different images were, and there was a really strong correlation between how quickly they could identify what the subject was and what they were looking at and how beautiful they thought it was. If it took them a long time to figure it out, they wouldn't think it was a beautiful image.
Exactly.
But I wonder if that's different for photographers that are used to dealing with it. It's interesting.
Yeah. They've done studies in hospitals, too. They've taken sick people, and they've put nature photography with this person, and they put abstracts with another one. They found that in every case, the person in the room with nature photographer healed faster than the people with abstracts on the walls.
Really?
Yeah. People on the abstracts, they just didn't get them. They can connect with them. But the people there laying there with the nature around them felt good. It made them feel good, and they could connect with it, and they healed faster. That's why so many hospitals now are going to nature photography.
Wow.
There's art consultants that base their whole business on buying nature for hospitals and the health industry.
And are you working with them?
Yeah.
Good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so you know, again, there's that connection. Same as you go to Yosemite or Grand Canyon, and there's that local photographer's got a gallery, and he's got all those icon shots, right? You're going to buy that because you have that connection to that shot that you saw, and you're going to take that home with you. Now, if that a photographer's in Yosemite and he's showing, you know, Glacier National Park images in Yosemite Park, he's not going to sell many.
But you're saying even if he's doing abstracts in Yosemite, you're losing the connection, you're saying.
Yeah, because you can't connect with an abstract like you can, you know, El Capitan or a Half Dome, something like that.
Well, when I get back to Chicago, I got to shoot the bean more.
You know, I don't know if you heard that podcast I did with Shamira Young out of.
I haven't had a chance. Oh, she lives here?
Yeah, she lives in up in St. Clair, I think. Fairhaven. And I did an interview with her. It's called ZenJoyable.
Yes. I wanted to listen to it on the way here, and I just didn't get a chance.
We're talking about this connection thing, and she says, you know, I went and shot this old building somewhere in St. Clair or something, and she says, and I put it in this gallery, and people love it because they have a connection to it. There's a history there.
Oh, they know the building.
But you don't know the building. I don't know the building, so it doesn't mean anything to us. So she says, yeah, I'm doing really good selling this thing. So I thought this thing would never sell because, you know, it's just an old ratty-looking building. But the people that connect with it had friends and family that worked in that building, all that kind of stuff, there's a connection. So that's the advanced part to me. You know, you can be all great with your camera and know how to work all of your f-stops, and you can work that backgrounds and all that stuff. But if you shoot a subject that nobody connects with and nobody cares about, it's not going to do any good. And again, you have to understand when you're posting your images online, there's what photographers like and what non-photographers like, and that makes a big difference.
Well, I find that a lot with, well, I shouldn't keep going on about myself, but the last thing, like, when I do a lot of HDR photography, and looking at other HDR photographers, and it's like, sometimes the worse the HDR is done, the more people like it, you know?
That's true.
You know, just in people that aren't photographers, the more that they like it, so.
Because it has a certain look that people aren't used to.
Right.
And so that is appealing to some people when they see something different, more illustrated
like that. Wow, how'd you do that? It's amazing.
Yeah.
But
You know, even in Chicago, there's icons that people are aware of in Chicago, building certain things. And if you're photographing that and selling them in Chicago, then people are going to want that, you know?
It is interesting when people contact me and they say, I want to buy some shots from your site. And I'm like, why those, you know? And they're like, well, I went to school there, or, you know, and it's like, there you go. That's it.
And if you can find those subjects that are easy for people to connect to, you'll sell more and you'll do much better. When I was in the art show business, my leaf images sold really, really well. Now, who doesn't like leaves?
I don't know, maybe people...
People drive up north on their vacations and shoot the fall color.
Just for the color.
They love leaves.
Huh.
It's a good feel, leaves. So they sold extremely well at the art shows. Leaves did.
Wow.
That frog shot with the green duckweed.
The one from back here?
Yeah. I never thought that would sell. What woman is going to buy a frog shot in an art show? Because 90% of my customers are women, right?
Okay.
It became my number one seller at every single art show.
Wow.
And I asked the women, I said, why are you buying this? Why would you put a frog on your... My wife would never put a frog in a home. Every one of them told me the same thing. I collect frogs. I have a huge collection of frogs at home. Yeah. And so they wanted this for their collection.
That's crazy.
And it would sell number one selling image at every art show. And not just like one or two above my next bestseller. Multiples past my next bestseller. I never realized so many women were into frogs.
I now I know.
But again, that's their connection, see?
Right.
And I had that that image was on my hard drive for 2 years before I even took it to an art show, because in my mind, I'm thinking, what woman is going to buy a frog to hang in her home?
Wow.
And so I just didn't know there was that much connection to it. Dragonflies are another one, you know? They'll sell pretty well. But you're not going to sell spiders in an art show. There's certain bugs that will sell, certain bugs that won't sell. And so, again, there's that connection thing. You know, most women hate spiders, so you're not going to do well if you show spiders to women.
Well, that's something I really need to think about, and my listeners need to think about when we're shooting down in the city with the different buildings.
Nondescript building, unless there's something really special going on in that building that, you know, that might attract somebody to buy it. But if there's more of a connection to that, then you're going to do better with it.
So, Mike, I know I've seen you in places. If you want to be a professional photographer, one of the best things you can do is get multiple streams of income, you know, because you never know what's going to go up, what's going to go down. But what about, you know, for someone like me, I have a full-time job. It's not photography. For a lot of my listeners, they're just passionate amateurs, but they love to make a little bit of money. What do you think are some routes that people could take? Is there one where they could just do, like, one thing and make a little money on the side, maybe pay for a new lens or something?
Yeah, there's two ways to make money that's selling your images and teaching workshops. Most of us that are starting out would not be able to teach a workshop because we're not well known enough or we don't have a following yet. Mm-hmm. So generally that doesn't work very well. Your only option is really either sell your images through a gallery setting. Selling them online is a waste of time.
Really?
I've had my website up since 2005, and I average two or three sales a year.
Really?
And, you know, and I've got, you know, 800 and some
people
images.
People are coming there all the time.
I used to have a storefront set up on there where you could buy the images. Nobody bought them.
Hmm.
So I gave up on the storefront, and I just really just show them for people for workshops and that. But, you know, I hear people say, oh, I'm going to set up a website and sell some of my images. It ain't going to happen.
Really?
I know a lot of other pros that will tell you the same thing. There's nothing happening on websites for sales, so that's a waste of time. Galleries would be the only place that you could find that may accept your work to sell, but that's a crapshoot, too. You know, you're not going to sell a lot in a gallery. You'll sell a few here and there, but it's just sales aren't very good in galleries either. Art show business would be the way to make a living trying to sell your prints, but that's mm-hmm. a real tough business because you have to do 30, 40 art shows a year to make a living at it. You know, some people try to go into that royalty-free, you know, stock thing and mm-hmm. selling images for 30 cents for a download and $10 for a full-size image, and
yeah.
some people make some money. I talked to a few that said they're on every you know, stock photography site out there with their images, and they make a couple thousand a year off it, but they're selling just literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of to make that money.
Right, and I have heard people that are successful and are making part of their living doing that, but they're going out every day shooting images specifically for that,
for
knowing
that.
What people want for that.
Exactly.
Similar to what you said, knowing what people want, like at a art show, but...
Yep. And it's generally images with people in them they like
for
advertising and stuff like that.
Right.
They're not nature images as much. A lot of times, for me, I love marketing. You know, I really love that, being online every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was up this morning at 5 o'clock posting stuff.
Yeah, I saw them. I got them.
I love that. I love that. Connection with photographers, and it's fun to me. So for me, it's not work.
Mm-hmm.
It's not getting up at 5 in the morning and go, oh, God, I got to go online and do this. It's like, I can't wait to get up in the morning to do this, right? So that's why it happens for me 365 days a year, and that's what keeps my name out there, and that's how people, you know, learn about you and follow you and stuff like that. But I see photographers that'll say, hey, I want to do what you're doing. I say, okay, this is what you need to do. Do a blog every day. Do this. Get on mm-hmm. Facebook. Get on all these things and just post the hell out of your images and just get out there and work it, you know. And they start off with all this enthusiasm, right? You see them out there working it and all that. And then after, you know, a couple months, maybe not posting quite as much.
Right,
and
right.
After 4 months, not as much. 6 months later, you're not even seeing them posting anymore. They didn't have the patience.
Right.
To wait. They were doing what they were doing, but they weren't really enjoying what they were doing. That's why after 6 months I got tired of it. See, I was just doing it because I loved doing it. And it built up after year after year after year to now you got followers, you know, because it takes that long.
You know, this is my favorite thing about meeting you today is to see that you really are enjoying everything that you're doing.
It,
I've talked to so many of my idols over the last year, and you're one of them, but all these guys, and I talk to them one-on-one, and they're like, oh, man, it's so hard, and this isn't, I've been to Yosemite 80 times now. I don't know about going to 81st time. And it's like, oh, that just breaks my heart, you know, but I love to see that you are loving what you're doing.
Yeah, someone else said that they said about that Zenjoyable interview I did, the woman posted, she goes, oh, I loved all the information. I loved your enthusiasm.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but I love running a business. I was in a painting contractor for 16 uh-huh. years. I loved it. The only thing that was a problem was the economy in the Detroit area. It was so bad that people weren't hiring painters. And so mm-hmm. kind of just like I said with the photography, if something's not working, you move on. Well, guess what? The painting wasn't working well enough to make an income.
But
I luckily got into this photography and it worked out okay. But, you know, I just love watching a business grow. And it's kind of like what David Duchemin said, mm-hmm. you know, like it's creative. And to me, it's a creative part of running that business, like he said. And each year you sit down and look, hey, I made X amount of dollars this year. And let's see what we can do to increase it for next year. And then you start trying to work angles and different things. And, you know, this year I come up with this online mentoring course.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the online mentoring course.
Yeah, it's got 16 sessions or 12 sessions.
Okay.
And each session has a learning part. And then with that, what you've learned, you have to go out and shoot images.
What are people getting when they go online? Are they...
Oh, I sent them an email, and then there's links to YouTube there where the videos are. These are private videos just for the people in the workshops. And then they and I have a video there, and they get to see the video on what they need to do. And so maybe it's elements of design.
Hi.
We might be talking about contrasts on one element. Next one, we might be talking about textures. And I'll say, okay, go out and shoot textures. And I give them all kinds of examples of what I do with texture. And they'll go out and shoot their texture images, send me three images. I critique them. And many times I say, you know what? You didn't do very well. Go out and do them again. I've done that quite a few times. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going
to
let them move on until they've accomplished the simple thing that we're doing. You
yeah.
know? And so then, you know, again, we go through 12 sessions. Each session has a different type of assignment, and they go out and shoot that assignment, and, and I critique it for them. And if they have any other issues or problems, I help them with those too.
So are those work at your own pace? People can pick it up whenever they want. It's not like August 1st. We got a new class starting. Right. Anyone can start them whenever they want.
The whole point of it was to make it so that we didn't have deadlines, and that this way it gives you the opportunity to go out and get the best image you can get without, well, I got to have it done in 2 days, and so I'm just going to randomly shoot whatever I can find. And that's why I always tell people
that's
when
smart.
I say, hey, you know what? You've got all the time in the world to get this done. You know, you kind of rushed through this, and I don't think you did as bad as you could. So let's go back and try to, you know, find some other images and resend me some new images, you know. Because I don't want you spending $249 and just kind of letting you get through the course without learning anything or becoming better, right?
So they got to get through all 12 of them, and you got to approve. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you got to... You got to actually pass them on each one for them to get through.
Yeah, yeah, because you know it doesn't do them any good, and you know to pay this money and not by the end of 12 sessions be a better photographer.
A lot of my listeners live in Chicago. Maybe they live in a big apartment building. It's not as easy. There are some great gardens and there are some great areas around Chicago, but you also do a lot of stuff at home, right?
Oh yeah, tons of it.
So I mean, these people that are, I mean, people living in a big apartment downtown, they cannot give the excuse that they can't do this close-up type of work because you're bringing stuff home and you're shooting it at home.
Exactly, and that's what we do in the boot camp. You know, when we set up and shoot indoors for 4 hours, we're shooting all types of different types of subjects and flowers and everything, and I show them how to do it indoors so that they can go home and when it's winter time and it's too cold to go out and shoot, or it's too hot in the summer and they don't want to go out, you can do it as long as you want right indoors, and it's real easy.
Yeah, so you guys have no excuse. Come on.
Yeah.
Get out there.
And that's one of the benefits of macro, is that when the landscape photographers, wildlife photographers can't get out to shoot, well, they're not going to shoot. See, we can shoot when we're in the off season or again too cold, too warm, whatever, we don't want to go out and shoot. We do it right in our house, and it's a big benefit for us. We can shoot 365 days a year, whereas and you know, a lot of people say, well, I go out and shoot, you know, landscape 365 days a year, but if you're working and you get home, you may not have light at 5 o'clock when you get home to go shoot landscape. If it's in the winter time. Whereas I can come home from a day's work or whatever at 5 o'clock and go down in my basement or, you know, set up in my kitchen if I want and photograph. Yeah. If you only have an hour a day to do it, you might not have time to drive to the local park, the local place to shoot. You might have 40 minutes of drive time and 20 minutes to shoot, whereas I can shoot for that hour in the house and it works out really well.
And you use natural light still when you're doing that, right?
Yeah.
Do you ever do strobes?
No. I usually will set up, actually I do my stairway as my main place to shoot.
Really?
Because I got a big giant window on the second floor that floods that stairway with natural light, so I shoot there most of the time. I also have a door wall that I'll shoot next to. So I usually shoot next to a window with a lot of natural light. And if it was nighttime, I'd be in the basement with the fluorescent lights overhead.
Really?
Yeah.
And that turns out.
Yeah. When we're shooting in the indoors in the conference rooms, you're basically shooting under fluorescent lighting, incandescent, sometimes a mixture of incandescent and fluorescent, and sometimes some natural light coming in.
And it's working
out. You know, your auto white balance, and it works fine. Everybody has good shots.
Wow. Well, I'll have to try that.
Yeah.
That's great.
And we manufacture our own backgrounds. We print up our own backgrounds to put behind flowers.
Yeah. Tell me just a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, say like we were shooting some grasses you know, heavy weeds and some of that, and you set up your camera, use your smallest f-stop number. It gives you the shallowest depth of field. And, you know, when you focus, manually focus, if you go a little farther, too far right or left, the subject goes out of focus.
Sure.
Well, if you take that manual focus and go all the way to the left or all the way to the right, that subject go to a solid blur. And when you get it at that solid blur, you photograph it, bring it home, print it out on a matte paper,
okay,
and you insert that behind your flowers.
So there's
indoors,
no reflection.
And yeah, yep.
That's why it's on matte paper.
Then you
huh?
get a nice, clean background, just like you would if you shot it in nature.
So if I'm shooting something with this print that I made, how far behind my subject am I putting the print usually?
It doesn't matter. It's a solid color, you know, whatever the print comes out.
Okay.
Whether it's close or far away, doesn't matter.
Wow.
And you can use a high f-stop to get your subject in focus. Doesn't matter if it reaches back and captures the background. It's a perfectly exposed and perfectly shot background.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have
to... So a lot of the shots on my website where I've shot my flowers indoors are all shot with those backgrounds.
That's what I'm saying. I have to find some of them on your site.
Yeah.
Probably. Would people even know that you did
no.
that? Or?
No, yeah. You wouldn't. Because when I show images in the workshop... These are images I shot in nature, all right? They look identical to the ones I have in my backgrounds wow. that I use in my fake flowers.
Is there anything you could do to screw that up? Like, I would think that'd be easy that, you know, you might if you didn't know what you were doing, someone might be like, oh, it just looks like you got a piece of paper back there.
No, nobody's ever
really?
Ever said, you know, it doesn't look right.
All right.
Never.
I'll have to give it a shot.
Everybody then. Just assumed it was shot out in nature, like all the shots that I took that were shot in nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are woodland sunflowers. The very first image that I posted online in naturephotographers.net
uh-huh.
was shot right here of these flowers.
This is like a historical spot.
Yeah. My very first image I posted online was one of these flowers.
Just one?
Yep. It was one flower. No, it was two. It was like something like this where you had two flowers side by side.
Uh-huh.
And well, they're a little closer together, and
both in focus.
I didn't know anything about sun and sun hitting subjects and diffusing all that stuff. And what happened was the sun was out and it was hitting those two flowers, and they were so bright that the camera was exposing for those bright flowers, and it darkened down and the background turned black.
Mm-hmm.
So it was these two woodland sunflowers with a black background, and I didn't even know what the hell I was doing. I got it. Oh, that's really cool. I don't know how I did it, but.
Is that the type of thing you'll try to do intentionally now, or
no,
or not necessarily?
I don't really like black backgrounds.
Okay.
I did yeah. when I first started. I thought mm-hmm. that was pretty cool because I didn't understand how I did it, and I just thought it was a neat effect. What I found in the art show business is nobody bought the black backgrounds.
Oh, really? I'm surprised.
Yeah, they bought white backgrounds, but the blacks okay. didn't sell very well.
Hmm.
I had all these flower shots with black backgrounds, and they I ended up pulling them out because
yeah, I guess
them.
If you're getting flower stuff, you want to make your house look brighter, maybe. Is
I don't know what it is because photographers love black backgrounds on flower
right.
shots,
mm-hmm.
but for whatever reason, the public didn't seem to understand them. Now maybe they thought they just didn't look natural with a black background.
Thought it looked like it was in a studio or yeah. something. Maybe.
The flower shots with you know normal black green backgrounds, something like that, they seem to be okay with. But well, the other thing to talk about connection is I had all these wildflowers, you know, like these flowers that we see out here when we're shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was going to do really great at the art show with my wildflowers because
right.
I had all these great shots. None of them sold. Yeah.
And why is that?
Because people couldn't connect with those flowers. They didn't know where they were.
Hmm.
They're not hanging a flower on their wall when they don't know what it is. So you know what they bought? They bought roses, they bought calla lilies, and they bought sunflowers.
Really?
Huh. They knew those flowers. They
right,
connected with them,
right.
so that's what they bought to hang on their own. They would never buy that flower right there, no matter how beautiful it looks and how well you've done it. If they don't know that flower is, it ain't going on their wall.
That's interesting.
This one shot of a trillium I had, it had kind of a feel of a calla lily. So this lady wants to buy this shot of this trillium, and she brings it up my table, and she pops it on there. She goes, I'm going to buy this. And I'm writing up the order, and I just have to casually throw out there. I said, that's a nice trillium, isn't it? And she goes, trillium? She says, I thought it was a calla lily. I says, no, it's a trillium. It's a wildflower. She goes, well, I don't want it now.
Really?
Yeah. She says, I don't want it. I said, well, it's still a nice shot, right? She goes, yeah, but I want a calla lily. It's not a calla lily. I don't even know what a trillium is. And so the sale, I lost the sale.
And to think of all the extra work to get a good trillium shot probably over...
It's an yeah. amazing shot, and it's one of the images that I don't sell to other photography very often. But it was one of the images that sold more than any other image to photographers.
Huh.
But yet nobody wanted to buy it because they didn't know what it was, the general public.
Yeah.
The only ones that bought the wildflowers in the first couple of years that I did have them in my booth, because eventually I took them out, in the first couple of years I'd sell a few of them here and there, and I'd ask them, why are you buying this to hang in your home, right? And they'd say, well, that flower is in the woods out back of our house. See, they knew what it was, and they had a connection to it, and that's why they brought it into their home.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's really
real
is strong.
Strong.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking that was just like the connection might just be like a little add-on or something, but that's like the whole deal. That's
oh, yeah.
like everything.
I should actually, in this, and right in the back of this park here, I shot Lily of the Valley, and I had a really, really nice shot of this Lilia Valley. And so one lady, I asked her, why are you buying this? She goes, oh, well, my grandmother had these in her backyard, and she's since passed on. And every time I see Lilia Valley, it reminds me of my grandmother. So it's a connection.
I've heard you say that before.
Yeah. The other lady said that her college sorority, it was their flower of their college sorority. She needed it for because of that. Another lady said that they made perfume out of Lilia Valley, which I didn't know.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. They make perfume out of Lilia Valley. That's her favorite perfume. And so she had that connection. And then tons of women told me they carried Lilia Valley down the aisle when they got married. And that was their connection.
Right.
And I sold the hell out of that because of those connections. See, but if nobody can connect to that flower, then nobody's buying it.
Wow.
And that's what I was saying earlier about when you teach people in the advanced stages of photography, that's the advanced stages, knowing what's going to sell and what's not going to sell and what works and what doesn't work.
Right.
The same with my all my images that I've won in contests, like the Woodland Smith Rice International Contest, all those big contests. All those images were simple subjects with everything in focus. I never, ever had a soft focus flower shot or an abstract ever win anything in a contest for me. It was always the simple subjects with everything in focus, two subjects.
That's interesting because we see the same thing in, like, our camera clubs, you know, that we're in. But the judges are very accomplished photographers.
Right.
So I always kind of thought it was because they were thinking to themselves, I just want to see everything in focus. Like, this was a technical accomplishment that you made, but I think there's something more to it that you're talking about here.
So, you know, non-photographers want to see it all in focus. They don't understand it. Photographers understand the depth of field, but they even want to see it all in focus, even though they don't necessarily say that. But in the judging that I've been in a contest, I've never had any of my images that I've submitted in soft focus images, abstract images, ever win anything for me. Not one. But the images that have won for me are the ones with simple subjects, everything in focus. When I was on naturephotographers.net the first 3 years on 2004, 5, and 6, I won first, second, and third place for image of the year in flora category, all right? Every one of them. In the first year, the image of the year was a yellow leaf on a green skunk cabbage leaf. That's all it was. And of all the thousands of images that were posted that year and all the flower shots that everybody's posting and all that, a little yellow leaf on a green background wins it. Tack sharp, beautiful textures, beautiful contrast, everything going there. Next year was a feather on top of a frosty leaf. And again, against all that competition of flower photography and all that other stuff, it ends up being picked because, again, it's something unique and different.
Uh-huh.
And it was all tack sharp and focused.
Huh.
And the third one was the one I told you is my most successful image, the green fern on a black log, all in focus, simple subject, two subject.
But
real easy concept.
But there's something else that you're saying, that they were also unique shots
compared to what everybody else was posting. See, that's the other thing, is that everybody's posting the same stuff.
Right.
They're all posting flowers on the flora category. I come along with a leaf on a green skunk cabbage and a little yellow leaf on a green skunk cabbage, and it's unique. It's different. I'm the same way if I'm judging a contest, which I've done at a lot of these conferences. If I see something that's different or unique, I tend to want to give that a higher score because I get tired of seeing the same stuff copied over and over and over again.
Interesting.
Same with Yosemite. If you found some amazing shot of some part of Yosemite that hasn't been done before, photographers are going to think that's amazing because, you know, they've seen El Capitan and Half Dome and all that.
Right. Well, we run into the exact same thing in Chicago for sure, you know.
Sure.
Whatever building it might be, find a different way to shoot it.
Yeah, and as soon as you locate that some little gem that's out there in the city that nobody else has noticed, you get attention for that and you get recognized for that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, if you do that on a regular basis, then you really
then
become
you've done
recognized.
Something. Yes.
Yeah, people put you way up here because he's got a great eye. He's out there seeing things that everybody else is missing.
Right.
And that makes a difference, too.
And a lot of photographers try and go out and they're like, I've seen this shot done before, but I'm going to try and make it just a little bit better, but that doesn't really do it. You got to do something different.
Yeah, because you know what? It's the same subject. Even though you can twist it and tweak it a little bit here and there, but a lot of people go, oh, it's been done already. He's got a little different angle. But it's got to be something pretty extreme to make it different. Otherwise, you know, it's more when you can go out into the field and find things that everybody else is walking by. And you make it really great.
Right.
And that's what sets certain photographers apart. And you get the guys like Art Wolf and Shaw's and all those guys that have made it. They had that eye. They were able to see that stuff.
Art Wolf talked about it. He said, you need to be able to find the photo within the photo. Everyone else is standing there shooting the landscape. You got to find what's the shot inside of there that no one else is seeing and make everyone see it with your image.
Yeah, and you know, that's something you can't teach people. You either have it or you don't. I mean, you can
you
teach
them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that makes me sad.
Yeah, because you can teach them all the technical stuff.
Uh-huh.
You can teach them the elements of design, look for textures, contrast, uh-huh. lines, all that good stuff. But there's people that will go out and see really cool stuff, and there's people that will see really boring stuff.
Interesting. But you don't think you can teach ways to find that cool stuff?
I think you can develop it over time.
Okay.
And it's really from studying what everybody else has been doing and
right.
then kind of copying, really. I tell people that all the time. I said, if you're not creative, copy what I'm doing. I mean,
right.
I'm teaching you
right.
how to do it. I don't care. You know, it's not
right.
a big deal. So some people don't have the creativity to go out there and find things. And some people are very, very good at it. I mean, mm-hmm. I see photographers that just blow me away every image after one another. And they're seeing things that other people aren't seeing.
Right.
And so somehow they have the ability to do that. And other people, they send you your images and they're just bad. It's not good. You know. And many times it's not so much the technical part of it. It's just the subject matter
mm-hmm.
is not good. It's not interesting.
Right.
And that's what I try to get people to understand is that, you know, I did a blog post last week. When I try to help someone, if they're asking me to look at their images, I need to know information. Are you shooting for yourself?
Right.
Are you shooting to sell to people and
right.
to get a lot of likes in Facebook and something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah.
Makes
I saw
a huge
you say
difference.
Something about that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you're shooting for yourself, then I'm not going to critique the subject matter.
Right.
But if you shot a crappy subject, I'm going to tell you, you know what? Nobody's going to connect with this.
Right.
You wasted your time shooting this because nobody can connect with this subject you just shot. But if you like it, you know, if you're shooting for yourself, then that takes that out of the critique because you obviously shot it because you like it. So now I'm going to critique the technical part of it.
Right.
But if we're critiquing for you to sell to people, I'm going to say, that's not going to sell. You know, that ain't
yeah.
going to work because I've been there and I know what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm impressed by how much, it sounds like every time you're selling an image too, you're asking them,
every
why
single
is
image.
It? Wow.
You have to because that's how you learn what the public thinks and how the average person buys and why they put things on their walls.
Wow.
And the great thing about the art show is, you know, like I said, in galleries, you might sell a few images in 6 months, but in mm-hmm. the art shows, you'll sell thousands of images, you know,
yeah.
In 6 months, thousands. So you talk to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And even the people that may not be buying it, you're talking and getting opinions on what they like certain images and stuff like that. So, yeah, the art show was a huge, huge experience for me because it taught me what people like and dislike and where to show images, where not to show images, stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
And it sounds like you're not discouraging people from doing the art show thing, but if you're going to do it, you got to put everything
yeah.
into it.
Yeah, because the one guy that went into the art show business that took my workshops and that,
mm-hmm.
and he showed me his image, says, what would you think I should show at the art shows? I said, well, because I'm not an, I don't know what to tell you because your image is you do African wildlife.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's nice. But is it going to sell here in Michigan?
Oh,
how many
yeah.
people in Michigan want to hang African wildlife in their homes?
Right.
And you know what? He bombed big time. I said, you got beautiful images.
Yeah, it's not because it was bad photos.
Yeah.
It's just that he's not making that connection.
And you know this. If you're decorating your house,
mm-hmm.
you decorate it to your taste and
mm-hmm.
what you like.
Yeah.
And if you don't... Now, you can't take beach scenes and go down to Arizona and sell beach scenes unless you're selling it to somebody from Michigan that moved
mm-hmm.
to Arizona. In the same way with...
Which I guess there are a lot
I've
of
got
them,
all
yeah.
kinds of beautiful cactuses and beautiful images of agaves and things like that from Arizona and California, mm-hmm. but I'm not selling them here in Michigan. Again, people aren't going to connect to that stuff.
Huh.
Look at this guy right here.
I agree.
All by himself, and again, the background's way off in the distance. You got a better shot of getting a little higher f-stop.
Do you ever worry about the whole two subjects, or is that not, you know what I'm saying? That's like whenever you go see macro photographers, that's the number one thing they say about composition.
I don't pay any attention to that.
All right.
Matter of fact, I tell this story in my workshop too. Did this program for Tamron in Minnesota.
Okay.
And I did a Friday night presentation for an hour and a half on macro how-to.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Saturday morning, they go to Minnesota Arboretum. And they all go out there for 3 hours from 9 to 12 to shoot. Now, I'm out there helping people, and there's a Tamron rep there, and some people from National Camera that are also putting this thing together. So 12 o'clock, they come into the Arboretum, and they've got people set up with laptops from National Camera, and they're downloading two of their best shots from the day for the 3 hours, two mm-hmm. of their best shots into their laptops. then they take those back to National Camera and they print out a 13 by 19 of these, each of these person's two images, right?
Okay.
Now at the National Camera store, they have tables lined up with, there was 33 people. There was only supposed to be 30, but they accidentally overbooked it to 33. Okay. They had 66 images lined up. They had three judges, and the judges pick out the winner, and then they win a Tamron lens. And there was some other prizes for second, third, and that kind of stuff. So I'm helping this guy, and I spot this pair of oak leaves, two oak leaves on a stem that flew out, blew out of a tree. It's laying on the ground, just like I picked up that leaf back there. I go, oh, these are some nice oak leaves. Mm-hmm. Picked them up. They're this nice green color. And I just carried it with me. And so we got to this area that had these orange, this orange plant, all beautiful leaves, all orange. And they're all nice tightly together, so there's no gaps and stuff like that. So I found this little area. I put those two oak leaves right on that area there. And I says, frame it like this. Go to your highest f-stop and shoot it. Get it all in focus. He wins the contest with that. The judges all loved it. Great image. Two subjects in there.
Interesting.
Two leaves, not three, not one.
Right, right.
Didn't matter. It was a great shot. So I don't worry about that
stuff. All right, good. I won't. Okay,
So this would be, I would shoot this as a vertical to include some of this neat stuff.
I agree.
There. And then, like I say, I'm watching my background.
Probably went too high for you there.
So I want to get down lower. Now, typically what I would try to do is get parallel to these.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Let's see, if I get parallel, I got a background that's four or five feet away.
So
unfortunately, I got to, you know, set up from that angle and then try to get a little extra depth of field to get them both in focus.
Do you do a lot of, like, bringing back your highlights? Or
you can. You know, you're shooting raw, so you can bring that back. I shoot JPEG, so I got to kind of get it done.
Really?
Yeah. All my images are JPEGs.
Well, that last one was good. Okay. Yeah, you're crazy. Living on the edge. Someone said that to me the other day. They're like, I'm not very good. I shoot in JPEG. I said, well, that's the whole reason to shoot in RAW.
Yeah.
Where did we come from?
Straight down.
All right.
I would go online and post, you know, about me shooting JPEG just to get all the photographers riled up. They would, too. They get so upset, and they're telling me, do you understand how much information you're losing? I go, yeah, I kind of have an idea.
It's funny how people get wrapped up in the technical details, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, landscape, wildlife photographers, they got to deal with a lot of high dynamic range.
Right.
And so when they're doing exposure adjustments, they have more issues pulling details out of dark areas and lightening up areas and darkening down areas. See, in macro, we don't run into high dynamic range. Very rarely do I have the high dynamic range in any of my images.
Yeah, and you...
So I do very little exposure adjusting. In post-processing, so I don't have that problem like they do. Here?
I would think that would be...
Seen a neat little shadow?
I would see that, and I would say I would avoid that immediately. You're saying that's actually a good shot.
Yeah, I've got shots like that, and people love them. Because it's unique.
To follow Mike online, go to www.mikemoatsblog.com. Moats is M-O-A-T-S. And you can keep up with him. He posts daily. Actually, if you sign up for his list, he'll get probably more than one email a day. Like he said in the thing, he loves doing it. And he's always pointing you to the newest, the latest, and greatest out there in the world of macro photography. And he's just so personable as well, as you could tell from the interview. So thank you so much for sitting through the whole interview. It was fantastic. Go sign up for Mike's workshops. You never know if he may actually make it around to Chicago next year as well for maybe our Out of Chicago conference. Let's hope that we can make that happen. But Mike is fantastic. Thank you so much for taking really like your entire morning going out with me. And I hope that you guys that actually sat through and listened to that, I hope that you really were able to get a lot from it. I know that for me, that whole experience, it really, I mean, well, here, I'll say one last thing that I'm going to throw in here, that a lot of people think that it's crazy to listen to a photography podcast that is only audio. But to me, to make great photographs, it's all in your head. And if you want to get better at it, you need to be able to think about what you're doing. And that can all be expressed through this audio podcast, and so much of what I've picked up here, I hope that you picked it up as well. It's amazing information. The business stuff was great too. Just the shooting stuff for macro. I mean, once you start to apply these ideas, you're going to find that it makes a world of difference. And I've just been shooting in the last week since talking with him, and I'm already finding that I'm shooting differently and I'm getting better images because of it. And it's these things here. You don't want to think of it as, oh, he didn't give me any real, real concrete tips. It's deep. You got to be able to think deep about this stuff. And if you do that, it's going to pay off for you. I promise that you're going to see your images get better and better. So, I think you should go back and listen to the whole thing again now, because the information is, it's something that you can apply to a lot of different situations. It's all part of growing as a photographer and as a creative artist. So that's what we're here for. And I hope that you really got something from that. So thank you very much for joining us. That's it for this week of the Out of Chicago podcast. And we will see you next week.